From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the 1960s when two people helped pioneer the urbanist movement. Of course, it wasn't known as urbanism 50 years ago, but then Holly White and Jane Jacobs saw problems in various ways when it comes to American cities. In 1961, Jacobs wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, which became one of the most influential works about why cities fail. White wrote The Last Landscape, and then later, City, Rediscovering the Center. He helped urban designers to see cities in a different way, beyond traditional roles as economic engines and transport hubs. Well, Jacobs and White planted a seed with an urban anthropologist named Katrina Johnston Zimmerman, who has tried to take their work to another level. Johnston Zimmerman believes that cities should not simply be more focused on the lived experience. That's a good thing. But she notes that almost all American cities have been designed and laid out by men. She recently pointed out it wasn't until the 1980s that the first American woman got a degree in architecture. The Community Design Center of Rochester is bringing Katrina Johnston Zimmerman to town next week, focused on a series of interesting questions. What would cities look like if they were primarily designed and laid out by women? What specifically could change? What does feminist design look like? My guests for the hour include on the line with us Katrina Johnston Zimmerman, an urban anthropologist who has got a lot more of a resume, I should say. Your work focuses on analyzing urban spaces to enhance the lives of people, the founder of Think.Urban, a research consultancy firm based in Philadelphia. Have I missed anything, Katrina? I don't want to sell you short.
No, thank you so much for having me, but it is quite long. I apologize.
No, it's okay. I appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time. I want to welcome in studio. We've got a couple of guests. Maria Fergiuelli, who's Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. As always, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And Monica McCullough is founder of MM Development Advisors, Inc. and co-founder of NY Wire. That's New York Women in Real Estate. Tell me a little bit about NY Wire, Monica.
Sure. NYWire is a loose association of women who are involved in the real estate profession, attorneys, architects, developers, accountants, all different types of folks working in that space in upstate New York.
And already, Maria, your event next week is sold out, I understand it, but you're here to tell us a little bit more about the event and that you often have waiting lists or you've got, you know, sort of corporate tables that book and don't fill. So there might be a way for the public to get involved with the event next week.
Yes, we do have a waiting list for people that are interested in attending the luncheon. Please register on our website on Eventbrite. And as seats open up, we will release those seats and notify you. So if you're really interested in going, please do that. But because the luncheon is sold out, we've created a few events. One is a workshop on May 30th, which is Wednesday, at our Community Design Center Gallery. That's a lunch and learn workshop. Eventbrite, I believe it's $20 seat, and you get lunch. And then we also have a meet and greet on the 31st in the evening at Ox and Stone that's open to the public from 5 to 7.
Okay, all the information online where?
At cdcrochester.org.
cdcrochester.org. Katrina Johnston Zimmerman, I have really enjoyed reading the interviews that you've done and checking out your work in various places. And there's a lot I'd like to talk about, but I want to start with a question for you about labels. And I don't want to get too bogged down with labels, but I've seen you say that for a while you didn't even really like to use the word feminist because there sometimes is a stigma attached to that. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely, particularly here. In this country in particular, I mean to say. In other places, it actually is already terminology that is used to say feminist planning as opposed to just urban planning.
When did that change for you? When did you feel like, okay, I can embrace the term?
Well, absolutely. I actually didn't consider myself too gendered for some time, to be perfectly honest. I just sort of thought, you know, we go through life and we do our work and there aren't too many differences. And it actually was an unfortunate, somewhat sexist experience in the workplace that kind of opened my eyes in a way. And I think a lot of women can probably relate to that in the last year, especially all the, you know, women's movements, Me Too and so forth that have come out. But I sort of had my own awakening and recognized that women are treated differently, especially in urbanism.
I read an interview you did with Creative Independent online, and there's a lot of themes I'd like to hit there. I think it's also valuable to just use a little bit of a definition, because when we talk about public space, as you say, it's simply defined as the space between buildings. So listeners, when you hear us talk public space, it's just what you might imagine, but that's a helpful thing to keep in mind. And before we even get to sort of feminism and design or what would be different if women were designing, I want to read what you had to say about millennial preferences because I think this turns a little bit of conventional thinking on its head a little bit. You said, quote, I'm a millennial too. We might think of technology as a fix for a number of things, but we value face-to-face conversation more than anything else. That's why we see the proliferation of coffee shops. We call that a gentrification issue or a hipster thing, but it's happening because we like to be around other people. We are social creatures, and we are certainly hurting ourselves when we do things that increase individual pods and the problems they bring. End quote. Katrina, tell me a little bit more about that. And I say that turns on its head a little bit because older generations have this idea that people of your age cohort are always on your screens, don't like face-to-face, are very insular, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So as a cultural anthropologist, a lot of what I do is track trends and behavior, our change in culture over time. And that includes my own generation as well as others around me. And like you said, public space. So I do a lot of people watching and observing people behavior, human behavior in public space. So one of the interesting things that came out recently was actually a study of public spaces based on William H. White or Holly White, like you mentioned in the introduction. And they found that a lot of people in public spaces on their phones or on a technological device of some kind are actually just sort of waiting for a friend to arrive or killing time before something else happens. But most of the time we do socialize a lot in these spaces, including third places like coffee shops. So I think that this is sort of a somewhat temporary trend in a way, or at the very least is not maybe as bad as people think.
I find that so interesting. And, so for all of our listeners who are thinking, no way, I see, younger people on their phones all the time. Katrina's point is it's killing time in between interactions. Now, the whole separate conversation is, does that eliminate our ability to sort of sit and contemplate and soak in emotion or thought? But that's a whole other thing. I find that very, very interesting. And if you look at the proliferation of coffee shops, spaces like that, as someone who's thinking about layout and design and what we ought to be valuing, how important is it? Let's get beyond the coffee shop then, Katrina. How important is sort of public park space or public open space, green space, to that kind of end, knowing that younger generations do value face-to-face?
Mm-hmm. I think also a lot of it is we will do what we're able to do. And that, also goes towards negative behavior as well as positive behavior. But without a place to sit or without a public space to, just play or to chat with friends or have that cup of coffee or whatever it might be, we're not going to do those activities. So providing good public spaces for people provides the opportunity for that kind of activation and that kind of healthy living or whatever it is that a person's doing there. I think we found this most obviously, the famous story is used often in Copenhagen, where before they pedestrianized streets and before they put out cafe tables and chairs, people never thought that Copenhageners, Danes would go outside and, drink a cup of coffee like the Italians do. But lo and behold, of course, you provide somebody the opportunity to do something like cycle safely down a street or sit outside with a cup of coffee or a glass of wine. And we actually do really enjoy those kinds of activities.
Maria, you want to jump in on that? Go ahead.
Yeah, we're also seeing a not just a cultural shift, but this generational shift where younger people are living outside more than say my generation. We pride ourselves on our privacy and we have these huge homes and we do everything within a controlled environment. But this younger generation is really interested in interacting in that social space. So they're looking at having smaller living environments and they're looking for these really active and engaging public spaces.
You want to add to that too, Monica?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's part of the trend that you're seeing folks wanting to move to more dense urban areas, to cities, to communities, to neighborhoods, to have that feeling of, your individual life, but also that connection to people around you, whether it's, your social activity or your interaction with your neighbors. Definitely true.
Yeah, as Monica just said, moving more toward urban areas, the trends are, and this is not, I'm going to make an observation just based on data. This is not sort of valuing one place of living or lifestyle over another, but the world is moving more towards cities. I mean, we know that just basic trends tell us that in the next generation, even more of our population will be concentrated in cities. And in the interview with Creative Independent, Katrina noted this in a broader context that I hadn't thought about. So I'll go ahead and read from that interview again and let Katrina expand on this. You said, quote, I had my aha moment when I realized we have not always lived in cities. We have been urbanized for like 30 seconds of a 24-hour day. And now we are a majority urban species, with most people on this planet living in cities, and that's only going to rapidly increase over time. We need to look at our cities as our habitat, not as some company-owned capitalist machine. It's an ecosystem, and we need to be thinking of it like that. End quote. I think that time scale is interesting because you're right. It is still a relatively recent phenomenon if we just look at organized civil society. So, Katrina, when you say we need to change the way we think of it, not just a capitalist machine, a company-owned space, etc., is that an indictment of men who have been designing cities?
That's a really good question, actually. It seems to be that the more recent urban development has been quite along those lines and has also been male-dominated. I will say when I talk to women about cities, they don't often bring up the commercialization of these spaces. They more often talk about collaboration, co-creation, and how we really need to be taking care of other people, or this idea of empathy or compassion when we are designing our cities for other people, because we essentially created cities as our own homes, and we've only been urbanized for about 10,000 years. And so through many different iterations thereof, we have sort of done some good things, done some bad things. And right now we're in a very unique time because we're very auto-dominated and, again, also very privatized to an extent. So I think there's sort of a critical lens that needs to be taken on that just in general.
I want to open it up for listener feedback throughout the hour. Number one, listeners, if you want to weigh in on any of this, if you want to think about the way we've laid out our cities and our public spaces, and if you think about them and you ask yourself the question, what would change if women were doing most of the designing? Do you think things would change? 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. We will also entertain your calls if you are sneering at this idea, if you think it's if there's something amiss here. This morning, teasing ahead to today's conversation, I got an email from a listener who was pointing me to a person who's having this huge cultural moment. And so let me ask Katrina about a quote that I just read in the New York Times. So you might have seen, listeners, last week the New York Times profiled what they call the intellectual dark web, which is sort of this loose collection of people, some academics, and largely what they are people who don't like what they call SJW, social justice warriors. And one of them is Jordan Peterson, who's a psychologist at the University of Toronto, who is selling millions of books and getting millions of hits online for every video he puts out there. And so the New York Times just ran a huge profile on Jordan Peterson himself. And this is what he had to say in that New York Times interview about men dominating certain spheres of public life. I'll quote from the piece in the New York Times. "The left," Peterson believes, "refuses to admit that men might be in charge because they are better at it. The people who hold that our culture is an oppressive patriarchy, they don't want to admit that the current hierarchy might be predicated on competence," Peterson said. End quote. I'll start with you, Katrina. I had some listeners pointing me to that piece saying, hey, Jordan Peterson, check it out. He's pointing out that this attack on the patriarchy is overdone here. What do you make of it?
Well, what's actually really interesting in terms of our urban environments is that women have actually been excluded from the opportunity to do a lot of it for many years. So again, this is mostly recent history, last like 100 years or so, 200. But women were excluded from certain educational programs until just recently. For instance, so we weren't able to be architects or engineers or planners and so on and so forth. I will also say I talk to a lot of young women who once they get to their private practice after graduation, end up leaving their profession due to discrimination or exclusion in that work environment as well, much like many other work environments. So I would say that there are a lot of other external factors, absolutely, that have created an environment where women are not able to impact it as much as men have.
I found that quote so strange. But listeners, I would love to get Jordan Peterson on the program. He's in Toronto. It's not too far away. We'll see if we can make it happen. I'll ask him about that because, you know, Maria and Monica, when you think about the nature-nurture argument, Peterson and many in sort of his ilk will say, well, there's natural differences. And whether it's architecture, urban design, computer science, et cetera, there may be fields where men just gravitate more to it. And what Katrina's pointing out is, how do you know that without a much bigger sample size of opportunity? Because women didn't even have the opportunity for so long. What do you think, Maria?
Yes, and I think the comparison of men to women, I definitely hold the philosophy that we have very complementary skills, so that there's a lot of things that men do better than women, and I think that there's a lot of things that women do better than men. And again, the fact that only one side is represented because of the lack of access to women is indicative of, you know, how the space has been created. But what we really like to promote at the Design Center is the understanding that space is for everybody. And so we have to take a close look at how everybody experiences space. And we all experience space differently, depending on our gender, depending on our culture and race, depending on our position. So.
Okay, Monica?
Yeah, I agree. And it's, you know, it's tough to generalize. It does a disservice to men. It does a disservice to women. But when you look around a table and you see a lack of diversity, a lack of inclusion, a lack of voices in communities that are broader than that should indicate a problem. And I think, you know, I was reading Katrina's blog yesterday, and, you know, she said it there, and she's referenced it here, that the reason why, as a woman, you know, is usually based on an experience. You know, you have experienced an issue where you haven't been included, where it very certainly isn't based on ability or merit, and then it becomes very real. And a lot of women who are in their mid-career point, I think they define themselves as feminists, not because they grew up that way or it's something that they naturally saw. It was a visceral experience that shaped their profession, their career, and their perspective, and that's how you know that it's real.
Again, listeners, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And we'll take your emails as well, connections@WXXI.org. You can find us on Twitter, @EvanDawson, or producer Megan Mack at MMackMedia. So, Katrina, sometimes when we have conversations about transforming our public spaces, we can be a little platitudinous or vague, and I want to be as specific as we can here, because when we talk about what might change if cities had been designed primarily by women and not men, what might change if we see sort of a redesign or a broad reimagining of public spaces, let's be specific. And I'd like you to start on the question of safety versus security, which you hit in that recent interview that I thought was so interesting. Can we start there?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, so...
Go ahead. The difference between the two is, I think it's one of the best examples for laying out this issue for public space in particular, and again, thinking about women. Most oftentimes, the issue of women in cities is centered around lighting. For instance, like, say you're walking down a dark alley and you don't want to do that, and so how do we make that better for women? Well, we'll add more lighting or something like that. There's also, you know, transportation systems, you know, trying to prevent harassment from happening. So in some places, they've created women-only train cars, for instance, where, you know, again, you can kind of feel safe and secure only around women and not be harassed potentially if that is an issue in that place. But I think it has to go beyond that, quite frankly, because it's not just about trying to prevent something through surveillance or segregation. It's actually a lot more about creating a good environment for everyone and therefore a place that makes women and children feel comfortable just from the get-go. So you see this a lot with security cameras or bollards or security individuals, you know, personnel, making sure that the place is quote-unquote safe, but it's actually that's a security argument. Safety is when a community is together and is really utilizing the space, feeling like they have ownership over the space. Maybe they can alter it. The environment is welcoming and good to be in as a human being. And therefore, it becomes a real place. And that actually can prevent a lot of the problems that you otherwise might try to fix with something like lighting, or for instance.
Yeah, and just reading a little bit more on that thought that you gave to Creative Independent, you said the example of safety versus security. In a secure place, as you said, you'll see cameras or police presence centered on defensive architecture that tends to be very stark. You'll feel different in a space that's dominated by security and things seem a little out of place. And you say in a feminist city, safety is created by a lot of diverse people being around. Rather than relying on technology or law enforcement to identify problems, the community can self-identify and prevent problems. And this is, I think this is a bigger and more important point than a lot of people realize in the current American moment, because so much of the division in society right now, whether people know it or not, it's not just the alt-right versus everyone else on the subject of whether multiculturalism is to be embraced or is to be feared. That's creeping into the public space and into conversations that are more mainstream, whether we want to sort of see it or not. And so It seems to me, Katrina, that you think multiculturalism is a buffer that creates more safe spaces. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that, again, that benefits society because our design influences our behavior. But we have to influence that design to begin with in order to create those spaces that are safe and welcoming for everyone.
How do our guests in studio feel? Multiculturalism, I see Maria's face. I'm reading your mind. You're thinking, you're smiling because the question seems so obvious to you on its face that multiculturalism is something to be embraced. But here we are. We are moving. We are self-selecting and self-segregating as a society, whether it's on ideology, it's the neighborhoods we live in, the people we do and don't want to be around. We are doing that right now. So again, it's not just the alt-right saying, be fearful of this. We're behaving in that way. Mm-hmm. And I think Katrina's point is an important one because she's actually positing that just putting security cameras and blue light phones and everything all over the place doesn't necessarily make things safer. That creates more of sort of a security state as opposed to real safe spaces and an embrace of multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. Maria?
Definitely. And I've been engaged in a lot of presentations in communities around the region. And one of the messages that I'm trying to convey is the fact that we try to create build diversity into all of our environment, that we know that diversity helps build a stronger community. We know that when we talk about investments, diversifying a portfolio makes a portfolio less suspect to different types of stresses. And the same is true for community. And this is why urbanism is becoming such an important issue. This is why people are moving to these more dense environments. And this is where you get vitality. Vitality occurs when you have diversity coming together.
Monica?
Yeah, and the importance of public space, you know, as Katrina mentioned, these areas that we're trying to build, ultimately it's to benefit the humanity. There's this human aspect to why we do all of this. And there's this innate desire to connect, to know, to create these connections with other people. It's important.
All right, I'm going to grab a phone call, and it comes from Eric in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi. My only comment is I think that women designing cities, we can't force these our children against farts and that sort of thing. Maybe speaker. Oof. Like, gosh, pretty industry, some of these things going.
Yeah, Eric, let me just jump in because it's just a terrible connection. I apologize. But I did hear him say that he thinks with more women involved in urban design space, there could be more space for kids, more family-centric. And I wonder, just broadly speaking, start there, Katrina Johnston-Zimmerman, do you agree with that?
Yes, definitely. And I think also to the previous point, one of the biggest elements of thinking about feminist cities or women-led city is actually that when you have women at the table or guiding a process, planning for women and girls, you're also planning for a whole host of other individuals in the community, especially people who might otherwise be marginalized. So it doesn't only extend to the idea of children or elderly, but it also, again, goes to other marginalized groups that can also benefit from planning for women and children.
Yeah, Matthew on Twitter says there would be, if more women were laying out American cities, there would be more public restrooms and more facilities for nursing mothers. So,
amen. That's
that
true.
That was fast.
True. More bathrooms. More bathrooms. I mean, you think about the amount of time you spend in public space and community space. You know, when you live and you want to socialize and be in exterior areas, it's not really a rocket science to think that people need a place to rest. They need a place to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, I also, maybe this is just my own sort of pet peeves, but I think of parks where my son plays soccer. I can't believe that there's, number one, no waste receptacles or no recycling receptacles. You know, that I think, can't we find a way, and I'm sure there's a cost here, but I don't mind if my tax dollars
right.
pay for that.
Or a water fountain.
Yeah, so.
To fill your bottle of water.
Okay, what I want to do here is I want to reset the hour, and then we're going to get our only break, and we're going to come back and address a question that just came in via email for Katrina Johnston-Zimmerman, which is a listener wants to know via email, how do people take control of their cities when capitalism can make a market commodity out of any lifestyle or social movement? And this person adds that when it comes to even the minimalist movement, that can be sort of commodified and co-opted. So I don't know if Katrina agrees with that, but we're going to come back to the question of capitalism in the public space. And let's remind you why we're here. We're here because the Community Design Center of Rochester has a series called Reshaping Rochester, and they invite a number of speakers throughout the year. What's been the theme this year, Maria?
This year is connecting, so building connections.
All right. It seems really appropriate for the venue you're on here. And Katrina Johnston Zimmerman is coming to town next week for an event that's already sold out, but why don't you let our listeners know exactly what is coming up that they can be a part of next week with Katrina Johnston Zimmerman?
Sure. We have a Lunch and Learn workshop at the Community Design Center on May 30th, which is Wednesday at noon. And then we have a meet and greet on Thursday at Oxen Stone from 5 to 7. And that is free and open to the public.
Online details all where?
At cdcrochester.org.
All right. We're talking about what cities might look like if they weren't all solely designed by men. And our guest is Katrina Johnston Zimmerman, who will be here with that discussion next week. She's an urban anthropologist whose work focuses on analyzing urban spaces to enhance the lives of all people. She's the founder of Think.Urban. That's a research consultancy firm based in Philadelphia. Let's get that only break of the hour, and we'll come right back to more of your phone calls as we think about that question of cities were laid out, design public spaces more designed by women than men, as opposed to the current setup, which is almost all men-driven design. What would it look like? 844-295-TALK. We're coming right back. Coming up in our second hour, a remarkable guest. You will want to hear the story of David James Savarese, or DJ for short. He is the star of a documentary film about his life called Deej that you can see in Rochester tonight. That's why he's in town. He is a non-speaking person with autism. He has broken barriers. He communicates effectively and will do so with us, telling his story next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me grab another phone call. Laura in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Laura.
Hi, thank you for having me and your panelists. Evan, your show is crucial to our community, and I want you to know that.
That's very kind. Thank you.
You're welcome. One of your panelists just brought up bathrooms, how important women's restrooms are. And here in the city, I'm seeing women's restrooms disappear. They're unisex. They are geared towards trans. And I'm a lesbian. So I feel like you're born what you're born with. That's your sex. So I think it's very crucial for women to take back our bathrooms, to take back our bathrooms as healthy, clean spaces for women, women who are nursing, young girls. And that is very important because it is going by the wayside in many places here in Rochester to have a women-only space to go in and do your private needs. The other thing, as far as the city, I live in the South Wedge where I've been here for 25 years, and I can tell you this whole gentrification that they're doing here is not working. We still have huge amounts of empty space, recent amount of empty space, and it's really become a place where literally 18 bars are able to function and maintain. There is not one grocery store. There's nothing that's main, you know, there's nothing here for survival. Low-income people got pushed out. People of color got pushed out. It's very, very young now. They drive like maniacs. There's this epidemic of rescue pit bulls that are attacking, you know, cats in our wildlife. And every time it seems to me that the city touches something, it's worse. It's not based in survival. I mean, there's these shops on South Avenue that have already closed and gone out, and what's left there has nothing to do with me eating, has nothing to do with me surviving. And I just want to say that I don't think the city gets it right.
Okay, and Laura, there's a couple of things there that I'll let our guests comment on, but let me just kind of go back to your first point because I want to understand it better. When you say that women are losing their bathrooms, you're not saying that, it doesn't sound to me like you're saying that there are fewer bathrooms. It sounds to me like you're saying that they're being converted to sort of neutral bathrooms or gender non-specific bathrooms?
Yes, you have to share them with men who make a mess of them. You have to share them with men who feel they have the right to invade women's spaces. We're losing our spaces. Women are losing our spaces.
Okay.
We're losing our only women's spaces. And I think that people are misguided. They think it's like a human right for a man or a trans man to go into your bathroom. It's not. Hmm. We are losing our spaces that are meant for us, for our privacy. I certainly would not go into a man's bathroom. It would gross me out.
Okay, all right. I don't want to get too bogged down.
It's not appropriate for me to go in there anyway.
All right, Laura, I do appreciate the phone call. At the risk of overgeneralizing, I do, in one sense, understand how you can look at the stars and be amazed that we went to the moon and yet also go to a throughway men's rest stop bathroom and think that humanity is doomed. But at the same time, I think that the trans population might take issue with some of what they heard from Laura. But look, there's a lot there. Let me turn to Katrina Johnston Zimmerman. Let's start on the question of bathrooms and public spaces. Laura's not happy with what she's saying. Generally, What's the approach that you think ought to be brought to public space and design when it comes to providing that as a resource, Laura? I'm sorry, Katrina.
Oh, that's okay. I will say the same thing that I say about a lot of things. It's really all about choice. So it's about providing enough options for people to do what is most comfortable to them in that sense and understanding where people are coming from to make sure that they have the ability to make that choice. So public restrooms, for instance, that are not attached to a private business, provide the option for an individual who can't purchase, say, for instance, a cup of coffee and use a coffee shop restroom to then use a restroom on their own in a public space. And so I think that that's a very important resource to provide to people. I will also say that I think that, yes, comfort in restrooms is in public restrooms in particular is very important as well. And I'll point to probably one of the best examples of a public restroom I've ever seen, which is that in Bryant Park in New York City. There are fresh cut flowers. There's an attendant. They're constantly cleaned. So it's just a matter of investing in what we deem is important for the public.
Okay. Some thoughts from Maria and Monica on that first part, and then we'll move to her second complaint when it comes to shops and what ends up in public spaces there. Anything you want to add there, Monica? Go ahead.
I'm pretty equal opportunity when it comes to bathrooms. I agree with Katrina. There's, certainly options are great, but, you know, there's no choice to need that facility. And, the more that we have that we think about that community space, the better we can utilize and more fully utilize the public space that we do have.
Okay. And then when it comes to her points on gentrification, I mean, this is a very complex subject that, you know, really needs its own time and has had it on this program and will continue to have it on this program. But let me ask Katrina Johnston Zimmerman how you define gentrification and if you see any effective means to guard against it, to guard against displacement, Katrina.
Mm-hmm. This is obviously an incredibly important conversation that's going on right now. There are a lot of different schools of thought. There's a lot of terminology to define. As you say, this sort of requires its own hour of conversation, to be honest. But gentrification can also mean improvement of a place, but not displacement. You can sort of change that definition to some extent. There can also be superficial levels of defining that, which do involve displacement, that I think are actually quite corporate and capitalistic in that sense, often initiated by developers. Really, it all comes down to community. If we really listen and take into consideration and make the priority the community needs that are there, we can help to improve people's lives through that humanistic approach without displacing or disrupting anyone's lives who already live in that neighborhood to begin with. So again, a very complicated conversation, but I think it all comes down to really being considerate of other people's needs.
All right, let me grab a couple of phone calls to sort of close the loop on that, and then we'll move back to our emailer who had questions about capitalism and how that factors in to design in the public space. Jack in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Jack.
Hi, I just had a couple points I wanted to make. You may have been mentioning it. As far as gentrification, I think if we built more housing options in these areas where young people are willing to spend money, like the South Wedge, if we reduced the zoning that removed developers' ability to build more apartments, then we wouldn't be pushing people out with these higher rents.
Okay. And so that's what you see happening in the South Wedge?
Well, she mentioned that we were pushing people of color out of the Southwest.
Okay.
And they were pushing people who had been living there. And I think that instead of taking housing that was there and renovating it for these new groups of people trying to move in, it would be easier to reduce zoning, build more houses, and then you wouldn't push people out of the area they've been living.
Okay. Jack, thank you. Katrina, you want to respond to that first, and then we'll expand on it, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Providing more options for housing is very important. Yes, definitely. I think that there is a conversation around zoning codes, which, again, another complicated discussion regarding height limits and building vertically that some people think can sort of prevent some of these problems from arising, like the negative aspects of gentrification. I would advise against too much of the vertical structure construction only because we know as human beings, we do enjoy being much more connected to the ground level and that urban fabric and the life that takes place on the street. It can be done, but it has to be done right, or else it runs the risk of just creating vertical cul-de-sacs that are not very good for anyone.
Yeah, I want to go back to that question on capitalism from a listener who says, how do people take control of their cities when capitalism can make a market commodity out of any lifestyle or social movement, even minimalism? Katrina, I'll start with you and we'll ask all of our guests on that. Go ahead.
This is definitely pertinent to my work because what I do is qualitative research, which is much more difficult to sort of explain to somebody or explain the value to in an urban environment as opposed to, say, quantitative or, you know, coming up with a cost-benefit analysis and so forth in that sense. But in any case, I really think that we just need to value more of the human element rather than continuous growth. And so if we continue to think of our cities as growth machines, as opposed to our homes for ourselves and each other, then we will continue to think of them incorrectly. Because oftentimes the human element is not necessarily going to be the thing that creates the most wealth, but it will create social capital and health and quality of life outcomes that are, in my opinion, really difficult to put a number to.
Do you consider yourself anti-capitalist?
To an extent, yes, absolutely, but not in terms of any kind of nomenclature or philosophy per se. I think a little bit more broadly, only because as an anthropologist, again, I have a lot of experience in many of the economic systems that we have created as human beings over centuries.
Okay, and then one question from a listener, and then I'll turn on the subject to our guests in studio. But Amanda wants to know if your guest thinks that we kowtow to developers in American cities too much. Katrina.
Yes, we do still do that. So what we have a lot of times in our cities in this country is a competition mentality where if you don't bring in the stadium or the, you know, the school doesn't upgrade something, you know, a new science facility or something that attracts a lot of new individuals to that city, or if you don't host a major event, that your city will fall by the radar. So I think rather than thinking of it as being the best place that attracts the most people, I think it really makes more sense to focus on what you are already and who you are already and how to improve that current situation, because there's a lot of good there already, no matter what city you're in.
Okay. Let me ask Monica and Maria to weigh in on this question on sort of how capitalism fits. And Maria, I know during our brief break, you said you wanted to explore this a little bit more. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, for one, we are understanding that placemaking is a really critical element in the whole equation. And so we saw that with Guy Worley's presentation last month from, he was the CEO of Cleveland. He was talking about how he got all these investors to put money towards building these projects because they recognized the value of placemaking and how that would be what would give them a competitive edge in attracting talent. So certainly, rather than thinking about economic development from only the commercial perspective, but thinking about it as a place, creating a place is very, very special. But also we're seeing that young people are willing to pay more for things that that we never gave thought to. They're willing to pay more for organic foods. They're willing to pay more for offsetting their carbon footprint. So their values are shifting in a way that that we can somewhat predict and that we can start to allocate resources to reflect that.
Monica?
Hey, I think, you know, my perspective is a woman-owned business, a business owner. You know, I think there's a lot of value that capitalism can bring to development. Certainly, you know, you incentivize risk and thought and innovation in some areas by providing a reward and an opportunity to, you know, generate resources from something that may have not been an appropriate place for a municipal investment or a municipal decision. The issue is that, particularly in the field of development, is you don't have everybody at the table. So the South Wedge is a great example. You know, you had the individual talking about why is all the space vacant and the types of businesses that are going into commercial space. You could look at an area like the South Wedge. There are probably four or five major commercial developers, owners, who control all of that space. So when we look at these areas and we look how similar they are and where's the lack of choice and lack of service to a broader community, some of that is because the individuals who are participating, who are allowed to participate, who are being incentivized by our municipality to participate, are not diverse, are not inclusive of the full scope of people who can contribute, who have an ability to contribute, whether it's with a social incentive or a capitalist incentive.
And Katrina, what I don't want to do is then follow up with you on a question that injects you right in the middle of a big roiling debate here in Rochester, of which you don't live here, so I don't. You know, it's a little unfair to ask you about this, but I want to frame sort of generally for you, because in our city, there has been a lot of debate over what happens with a prime piece of space that's, you know, that could be public space downtown, and they call it Parcel 5, and they did exactly what you just said tends to happen in sort of. I don't know if it's usually male-dominated design spaces, but capitalistic spaces. There's a competition aspect. There's a big glitzy thing, a stadium, something that goes with it. In this case, in Rochester, it's a performing arts center and attached to more of a housing complex. And that was competing against more of a park and green space. Though, again, I know the people behind that said this is not a park, but I take the point. But there were a lot of differences of opinions about what that space should be. Should it be more accessible to more people? Should it be more green? Should it be more open? Should it be more high-rise? And the city selected a performing arts center that has been a lightning rod. Now, there's a lot of people who say, look, we need downtown development, and this could be a magnet for downtown. There's a lot that could happen here. Of course, there's been a lot of pushback from others who don't think it's very egalitarian. And I wonder, just in general, this notion of the competition aspect. This is a city with a woman of color who is the mayor, who oversaw that competition and has been very vocal in her support of the Performing Arts Center. Now, this is a sample size of one here, but do you think, generally speaking, when women are helping or leading the questions on what happens to public spaces, we don't do things this way? That we do things in maybe a different fashion? Or am I missing maybe part of your point?
I will say that, without getting too far into Rochester's
sure.
current situation, as I don't have all of the understanding per se, I will say that one of the key points of talking about women in cities too, of course, is, again, we don't want to overgeneralize, you know, either biologically or psychologically on women as compared to men. It is entirely possible that, and it has certainly been the case that, you know, a female body does not necessarily represent a feminist mind. There are also other systems in place, oftentimes that you have to work within, or certain assumptions that are made that may just be ill-informed, for instance, right? So it's not necessarily to say that whole situation is in any way contradictory or complementary to sort of what I tend to advocate. But on the subject of the parcel in particular, I will say that I think a public space can be a huge attractor to a downtown. Absolutely. We've seen that in many cases in cities all around the world, rather than something like an institution, which also is incredibly valuable, which is just to say that they both could have a lot of merit. I have actually been to the site of the still vacant lot, and I would say that actually would be a fantastic place for a park, in my opinion. That's just my humble non-resident opinion, but I could definitely see the value in that. I think, most importantly, though, it's up to us to make the city that we want to see. And I think that's really the point that I try and drive home as an urban anthropologist. We make the city. It is our place, and we have the ability to make it the best kind of place for us.
Okay, and as we go toward the end of the hour here, I'll tell our listeners before the hour is over, Maria from the Community Design Center will remind you how you can meet Katrina Johnston Zimmerman next week and be involved. We'll let you know before the hour is over. Let me grab a couple of other listener comments. Don writes to us and says, I'm okay with zoning laws, but I'm less supportive of planning. Old cities like Rome and Paris grew organically and are wonderful places. Are planning and organic growth at odds? And if they're not, how could they fit together? Katrina?
Also a very complicated conversation.
That's this whole hour, too.
Which I apologize for. It actually, we have been planning our cities this entire time. It's just a matter of who's doing the planning. So whether this is top-down or bottom-up, even organic growth and creation of cities is not quite organic. There's negotiation, there's situations to take into consideration in terms of site and placement based on even just your neighbors, even if you were making your own house next to somebody else's a long time ago. So that without getting too far into that, I think that things need to be planned. It's just a matter of what our perception is when we are doing the planning itself.
Okay. Maria, how do you feel about that question on sort of planning versus organic growth?
Well, I agree with Katrina. It's a factor of, you know, whether it's top down or bottom up. But we do understand that old cities evolved in a certain way that helped people perform all the needs that they had within their neighborhood. And this is kind of a concept that we're returning to now in what we call new urbanism. Through the development patterns of the past 50 years and with very good intent, we started to kind of sort uses and little by little the zoning kind of took over and has created the kind of spaces that now are either single use and don't allow for people to have the function within their neighborhood. So we're kind of going back to that kind of organic style of urban planning, understanding that we need diversity, we need multi-uses, we need multi-uses within buildings, we need multi-uses within communities.
Okay, Monica?
I have nothing to add. That was great, great comment.
It has been a great conversation. Katrina Johnston Zimmerman, and my last question to you will be just to kind of remind our listeners on as complex a subject as, I mean, it sounds like a simple question. What would happen if American cities had been designed by women as opposed to almost exclusively by men? If cities get redesigned or reimagined, what might be different? You said earlier in the hour that you kind of eschewed the label of feminism. You didn't think too much about the construct of gender in your life, that you thought that differences are sort of exaggerated. And some of our listeners are sending me emails saying, hey, you know, if you're saying men are more capitalistic, I thought there weren't that many differences. And that's this whole other conversation on socialized nature versus nurture. But as we think about design going forward, some final thoughts from you, Katrina, about what the benefits could be to American cities if more women are involved in redesign.
When I talk to women about cities, I do think that they think a little less compartmentalized about some things, or at the very least, they tend to take an entire picture into consideration. They think very holistically about an environment. They think about where the woman was before she got to that place, where she's going after that place, or, you know, what she can do if she has a child with her versus if she doesn't, or if she's with a group of people, or she's with an elderly parent, for instance. I think that women tend to take a lot more into consideration. And again, this could also just be because of our experiences in contemporary society, not necessarily nature, but maybe more a little bit nurture. So barring that complicated subject, I think that more importantly, our cities would just be different. And I think that that could be a good thing. They could be quite similar. But I think that when we insert more diversity into anything, we're going to have a better outcome for everyone. And that really is the point that I hope to get across.
Next week, 25 seconds, Maria, you got to tell us what's coming up next week.
All right. We have the luncheon on May 31st, noon at the MAG. If you are interested, the luncheon is sold out, but we do have a waiting list. Please go to our website, cdcrrochester.org, to see that and other events related to Katrina's visit next week.
cdcrochester.org. Always good to have you. Thank you, Maria. Thanks for being here. Our thanks to Monica McCullough, founder of MM Development Advisors, Inc., and co-founder of NYWIRE, New York Women in Real Estate. Nice having you here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Katrina Johnston Zimmerman, an urban anthropologist. We'll see you next week, and thanks for making time for the program today.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to coming back.
All right. A lot of great feedback from our listeners and a great opportunity next week to continue that conversation facilitated by CDC Rochester. All right. Short break. Much more connections coming up.